Welcome to the Matt Hummer Podcast, episode 31. I'm Mo, I'm here with Luke and Jonathan. How are you, fellas?
Pretty good.
Yes?
Yeah, good.
Pretty good, yeah. Ratings out of 10?
I'd say a solid 8 out of 10.
8?
Solid 8 out of 10.
7.
7, yeah.
Yeah.
Feeling about a 7. A little bit tired.
I'm too excited to be here.
No, mate, we love it. Don't forget the new issue, or latest issue at least, of Metal Hammer is on sale now. It features our world exclusive interview with Disturbed. You will not read about the new Disturbed album, where David Draven has been, all the rest of it, anywhere else but here. You've got about a week or so left to get your grubby mitts on it, so get all over that immediately. Those of you that have been asking about whether we're going to be doing a Disturbed bundle, pay very close attention to metalhammer.com on Friday, possibly Monday, but in the coming few days we'll have something special for you guys, because a few of you have been asking. It is coming, so watch this space. It's been a bit of a quiet week,
yeah,
in the world of metal, as far as gigs go at least. It's normally packed this time of year, isn't it? But it's not quite as leery.
You've had loads lately, and none of us have left the house, I don't think.
I don't know if it's like, I don't know if it's to do with like sort of in the wake of festivals, but it just soaks every gig up.
Yeah, a lot of bands have done the rounds and all that. I did go and do a conference for the lovely people at Newsic in Nottingham, so thanks to everyone that came down for that. It was lovely to meet people, talk about Metal Hammer and the metal industry and everything else. So that was jolly good fun. Plenty going on in the world of metal outside of that, though, such as Luke Morton.
Such as? Oh, I see.
That was a segue to news.
Yeah, an exclusive announcement through Metal
Hammer. World exclusive announcement. Come on, what's going on?
Meshuggah are headlining Arctangent next year.
Fucking hell.
The only UK gig of next year.
I for one welcome my new alien sounding overlords.
That is going to be a gig. You went to Arctangent this year, Luke, reviewed it on the podcast a couple of weeks back. Yeah, one of the kind of most exciting young British festivals going, and they've just booked one of the greatest live bands in metal.
And it makes complete sense for that festival.
Like, well, half the bands on their bill are Meshuggah.
Well, that's
disciples of Meshuggah.
Well, you see, a lot of what they do is, I guess, post metal rather than tech metal. There's a lot of just, you know, fret wanking going on. A lot of the bands sort of go over my head. But like you say, so many of those bands must owe a lot to Meshuggah, and just to have them come in and play. And the tent they've got as the main stage is that sort of big marquee thing, quite high ceiling, but a massive stage. To see the Meshuggah stage set on that is going to be amazing.
Well, initially, "gent" was a euphemism for "we sound like Meshuggah."
Yeah, pretty much.
And they're just, it's a difficult one putting Meshuggah on there, because they will blow. No matter how good every band is,
yeah,
that will show you what true mastery is. They're like my favourite live band, and they're the band that I go like absolutely fucking crazy to in a mosh pit.
I've witnessed this firsthand and can confirm.
Yeah. So, but I get a weird phenomenon every time I mosh out to Meshuggah. Is that normally I've gone to other mosh pits, I'm fine and everything, but Meshuggah, I'm out of breath and my arms are aching after like one song. And I had to think, why? Why is that? And the reason I realised is that the music sounds made for like bodies with more joints than a human body actually has.
So you have to make up for it.
So I feel like I'm overcompensating for it every time like I'm mushing out. And yeah, they just do weird things to your brain, and just, there's nothing to compare to them, even though lots of people do try to compare to them.
Very cool. We do have an exclusive interview with Meshuggah about what they have planned for Arctangent and what else they've got coming up in the next issue of Metal Hammer, which is on sale next week. We'll be going into more detail on that on the next podcast.
Hooray.
Who bloody ray. Speaking of hooray, oh my word, one of the biggest metal tours ever, probably, you could safely say.
Yeah, it's mad. It's Ozzy and Judas Priest.
Ozzy, not just Ozzy, Ozzy Osbourne's last ever full UK tour.
Yeah.
Supported by Judas Priest. On the back of their best album in 25 years or more, I think. Nearly 30 years.
It's going to be a night out, isn't it?
It's going to be a night out as well.
Yeah, I hope they just give Priest the full sound, not give him like backing band PA.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think they'll do that for Priest. If it was like a new band, they might, you know, do him injustice, but I think it's Judas Priest. They all know each other.
No, of course.
You've got to assume Priest is probably going to get an hour as well, like, or something to be on before Ozzy, so that's going to be wicked.
Yeah, it'll be a proper, I mean, it's at the O2, so hopefully Priest will be able to bring some of their stage show.
Yeah.
From when I've seen Ozzy, I would say Ozzy doesn't have as much of a proper like stage set as Priest do, So hopefully it'll mean they can bring all their little bits and bobs and props and stuff.
So I've never seen Aussie Solo. So
yeah, we talked about this before. Yeah, I'll tell you what. There's not rarely been a better time to see him, because quite honestly, I found him up and down on the Sabbath reunion dates that ran across those few years. I've seen him twice since Sabbath, and both times he's been vocally maybe the best I've ever seen him.
Oh shit! Okay.
He is 60 something. So he's going to be kind of not bounding around stage quite like he used to and all the rest of it. But vocally, he honestly sounds really, really spot on. I don't know what's got into him, but it's good.
I'm going to try and go to the Birmingham show, because that would be a big
surprise. Oh, God, yeah. There. Didn't even think of that.
Both from Birmingham, both playing what I imagine, I think it's the NEC.
The home of metal.
Best time I saw Sabbath ever play was in Birmingham.
Me too, when they played the smaller venue.
That venue.
That was wild.
They got times there, but...
Yeah, that was amazing. Yeah, that should be great. Please play more stuff from the 90s albums, please. Anything off Osmosis and No More Tears, and I'll be moshing like a maniac. Please. What else is going on?
Well, Villa Volo has announced a new band.
Ah, what Vil did next.
Indeed. The question will soon be answered.
What do we know about it?
We don't know much, really. There's a new single coming this month. And the band is called Villa. Is it Villa Vallo? How do you actually say his name? Villa Vallo. Good. I've never really heard it out loud.
I've met him at least twice, and now I feel bad that I think I might have been saying his name wrong all this time.
He's like, "Hey, Steve."
Hey, Vile.
Yeah, let's call both Villa and Agents, because he's teamed up with the guitarist and from the band Agents, Issa Pelainen, blatantly pronounced wrong. And they've got a new single coming on the 21st. On the 21st of September, and the album is coming next year. And apparently, they've been doing this for years. Wow. It's been three.
Didn't you know?
Well, no, yeah. It's 3 years in the making, apparently, this new project. But I don't know what to expect, really. I'm guessing it won't sound like him. Maybe it will.
From what I have heard, it's not going to sound a lot like him. I think it's going to be, like you said, something he's been working on for a few years by the sound of it, a bit of a side project that he can now get out of his system now that him is no more. Rest in peace. I imagine that whatever this will be, it probably won't be the next thing he does, if you know what I mean. I don't think this will be like the definitive Villa Velo thing for the next few years. No. I think it's a project he's been working on a while, and then maybe we'll see something else from him down the road.
One of those projects where you get together with some friends and you sort of run through your record collections, and it's kind of like in a particular retro style. So maybe like an 80s synthwave album, you never know.
It is wishful thinking on your
part. Oh, man. I reckon he'd be great at putting together something like that, to be honest. You never know. I imagine, not musically, but I imagine it's similar to what Nergal's done with Me and That Man, like something he also interested in doing on the side. Again, I've not actually heard any of it, so I could be talking trash. But what it sounds like.
It does sort of have that Me and That Man vibe, and the same that, what was his name? The guy Nergal did Me and That Man with. John Walter? Something like that. Just sort of like this acclaimed older musician that Nergal was a big fan of, and they just ended up working together. It sounds like this has that similar vibe to it, really. I don't know the band Agents that he's teamed up with.
But it may be something really different from that other band, from Agents as well, too. Maybe just do like a proper old school blues record or something.
That'd be amazing. Yeah. Or a jazz record. Jazz is coming back, guys. I'm telling you.
Telling you now.
That's your hot tip, is it?
My hot tip.
God help us.
I love jazz. a bit of Finnish elevator music could be good.
Why the fuck not? there's been some, not kind of particularly milestone anniversaries this week, but we've been talking about two big albums this week. Toxicity was one of them. I was jamming that on the way in today.
That
turned 17 yesterday, I think.
As we record,
called it one of the greatest metal albums of the 21st century on Instagram, and a few people took umbrage at that. And I thought,
really?
Ridiculous. What's the matter with you?
Yeah, idiots.
It's fucking Toxicity. Like, it's. It's a 10. It's a 10. One of the greatest albums ever, no doubt about it. Anytime the title track or Chop Suey or Aerials gets dropped, it's bedlam.
Aerials is fucking brilliant.
At a rock club is what I mean, but of course
it's just in your house.
In my house, on my iPod. And Power Slave turns 34 this week as well. The grand old age of 34.
As the Iron Maiden oracle of the podcast, where does Power Slave sit in your rankings?
It
I think Power Slave is one of those where I think the great thing about being an Iron Maiden fan is that they've been so consistent through two very specific patches of their career, the 80s and the 2000s. I think they did a lot greater stuff in the 90s as well, of course, but I think it's generally accepted that those two ends of the sandwich, if you will, that is Iron Maiden.
<That's>
I don't know where this analogy is going. Those are kind of the two golden eras, as it were. And I think what your favourite Maiden album is, or which one you gravitate to, as with many bands, just depends on what your first one was, or what, you know, you kind of grew up with. So for me, I think Power Slave, I think for most Maiden fans, it's kind of generally accepted as the definitive Maiden album. If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Whether it's your favourite or you're not, it's not your favourite, it's seen as the... If you're going to play someone a Maiden album, I think a lot of people gravitate towards that.
Yeah, I think there's two ways of looking at it.
I mean, it's a 10 out of 10. It's an absolute classic.
I actually think there's one or two faults with it myself.
Interesting.
I'm sure I'll be going. But it's one of those things where, like, it captures lots of different aspects of the band.
Yeah, exactly.
Like the early, you know, the earlier harder bits and the bits of the progressive elements that came in later on. But that also kind of means that it's kind of a sort of transitional album. Like, you know, like... In some ways,
I see what you mean. Yeah.
Not only my favourite Morbid Angel album, but probably one of my favourite metal albums of all time is Altars of Madness. And I love it because it's a transition album. Like, because that album could not have happened at any other time. Like in the sort of the changeover from thrash to death metal, and so there's lots of different energies there that couldn't have happened at any other year.
Yeah, a weird one for me like that is, I know it sounds like a bit of a weird tangent, but Music for the Digital Generation by The Prodigy is my favourite Prodigy album, because it bridged the kind of weird psychotic rave of the first album into the big beat heavy kind of almost like riffy dance music that they did on Fat of the Land.
Yeah.
So I know what you mean. Like sometimes bands find that middle ground, which to some fans is... It's perfect. That's
But also there's like with those kind of albums, there's real kind of energy there, like people testing out their powers. Like you know, Altars of Madness has this wild energy, but also on a very different tip, I really like Reroute to Remain.
By Inflames, really?
Yeah, because they're...
It's a great album.
Yeah, because you can tell the excitement of all this new stuff they've got at their disposal, like ideas and things they've got at their disposal, and there's a kind of real amazing energy for that.
Definitely. So when it comes to Power Slave...
Yeah,
I mean, I see what you mean. Like, after this, they went into Somewhere in Time and then Seventh Son, which kind of brought in, like, really heavy synth, more progressive elements. Seventh Son of a Seventh Son, personally, is my favourite 80s Maiden album. But, I mean, Power Slave's right up there as well. I mean, Ace is High. I struggle to think of a greater opening heavy metal song ever. It is metal in of itself.
Oh, yeah. But also, like, What I Want To... Like, I don't think I've ever...
Yeah, exactly.
I can't remember the last New Year's that I had that wasn't 2 minutes to midnight. And I actually had to demand... I went to, like, a metal night, and I was chatting to the guy who was running it for New Year's, and I said, wait, he wasn't going to put 2 minutes to midnight. I actually demanded he play 2 minutes
to midnight. Do you know who I am?
No, just you can't have a metal night. You can't go to metal... You can't spend New Year's without it.
Yeah.
Without very 2 minutes to midnight.
And a very prophetic song as well.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a great album. Like, I know what you mean about you know, it being a little bit imperfect, but I struggle to find a bad moment on it. I mean,
I'll tell you again,
it's kind of the middle section. Maybe when you start with Ace is High and 2 minutes to midnight, and you close with Back of the Village, Power Slave, and Rime of the Ancient Mariner.
Yeah.
I mean, it was any band would struggle to be that consistent throughout an entire album. Like, those are 5 of the greatest metal songs ever written, all within the space of 8 tunes. But I don't. There's nothing on there. I don't think.
I think Lost for Words is slight. Like,
it's daft, but I like it.
It's just like some of
which applies to a lot of metal. To be honest, that I like.
And it's just that some of the twin leads. It sounds like music to a gardening show in the 70s.
Okay, I know what you mean.
Alan Titchmarsh losing his fucking mind.
And as much as I love Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, I love the fact they have like a long song leading up to it. And when you listen to, and what I love about it is like when you listen to it, it doesn't start out like it's going to be 30 minutes plus. You know, it's got such a tall kind of riff, and so, but it does kind of keep changing. But then I just feel that for its length, it doesn't go off on enough of a journey, because the sound is kind of quite clipped on it.
Yeah, like the later, longer songs. Like, especially nowadays, their long songs really take you.
Yeah, yeah. Places. And I just felt that
doesn't
like,
sit on one pace.
It feels like it's a little bit constrained for a 30-minute song, like sort of like the Sonic Ranger goes through. As much as I love all these dynamic shifts, so but you know, there's other bits, there's other riffs that like. So you know, that's why I always think when I listen to a Maiden album that it's, you think it's not exactly rocket science, but no other band on the planet could do this.
No.
So there's certain riffs and the way they put certain riffs together that it's just only you could ever do this, and it still has all the things that I love about a Maiden album, but it's just when you love a band to that extent. You know, you're probably a bit more critical sometimes than you would be other way.
Yeah, or you're just a blind fanboy like me.
I love it.
But yeah, it's I know Dom Lawson, esteemed Hammer legend. It's his favourite Maiden album. I know it's a lot of people's favourite Maiden album. And like I said, I think if I was going to play someone, if someone said, play me an Iron Maiden album, I would almost certainly play them Power Slave. But as I said, I personally would rank Seventh Son higher, maybe highest out of all of them, and I'd probably put Number of the Beast higher than that as well. But yeah, what an album.
Happy birthday, Power Slave.
Happy birthday, Power Slave. And Toxicity, which is right up there as well.
Which I prefer to Power Slave.
That's fine. I might as well. It's kind of sacrilegious, isn't it?
Yeah, but after all that.
I know. Well, we'll do Toxicity another time.
A year from today.
Yeah, when it hits the big 18. we got tons of readings, questions with, well, very interesting points to go through this week. Don't forget, it's www.metal. No!
Oh,
fucking hell!
Every time.
Not every time. I'm going to write last week. facebook.com/metalhammerreaders. We had a reader that joined the group this week from Cuba. Did you see this?
I did not see this. I saw you tweet about it.
Yeah, we had a reader join the Facebook from Cuba, and he was talking about how he loves the magazine, and it's really hard to get physical copies of Metal Hammer where he is. He's managed to collect about 20 of them, and they're like prized possessions of his. Another reader clocked that, commented on it, and said that he doesn't always get physical copies, but every time he does, once he's read it, he's going to send it on to this other guy.
Aww.
One absolute hero. Nice. So yeah. We love you guys. Thank you for supporting us and supporting each other. You guys rule. This question, having said that, comes off Twitter because it's someone called Rhythm88.
Clever.
So there you go. That person asks, what do you consider the best prog metal at the moment?
Gojira.
Oh, we count Gojira. Okay.
This
is what my first thought was, what counts?
Yeah, that's okay.
If Gojira counts, then yeah, Gojira, that's...
That. Yeah, so they're the second one I wrote down because I thought everyone likes Gojira. But I also wrote down Tesseract.
Yeah, out of the gent scene, Tesseract definitely the best band.
And I think
in that scene.
They've sort of, to use a word you used, Jonathan, transcended the gent scene. I mean, they've become a slightly different band now. After seeing them at Download this year, it feels like they've just become an expansive metal band, if that's a phrase, where it's like it's less about going and it's more just like fucking hell, the size of these songs is amazing.
That's one of the sound bite of you doing that.
Yeah.
For like a text tone.
What they're doing now, like the past two albums have been brilliant and the live show is ridiculous.
Yeah,
now.
I think it went under the radar a bit until we banged on about it, that Tesseract show at Download, but that was definitely one of the highlights of the weekend.
Yeah, I think it's the best band I saw on Friday.
That's awesome. Back that, back Tesseract, back Gojira.
The other one I've got written down is the Mars Volta, who I think are fucking incredible and don't get anywhere near as much recognition.
Are they still putting albums out?
No,
because it says at the moment.
I don't know at the moment, but they're still relatively
love the Mars Volta.
Yeah,
I think. And I've got a thing about, I love his voice, I've got a thing about squeaky voices, I can't help it.
That and
Pinky in the Brain. Yeah, but they're just, but yeah, they're an amazing live band as well too.
See, I've seen the live once, and I thought they were shit.
I saw them at the Brits Academy, and I loved it.
I see, if it's their own show, I think it would have been great. I think I mentioned it on the podcast before, where they just treated it as a jam session, a sonosphere, couldn't really be asked. But Bedlam and Goliath, I think it's incredible. D. Louse and the Comatorium is like a 10 out of 10 album. Francis the Mute is amazing. Like, everything they've done is so good. And yeah, if you like If you don't know the Mars Volta, then listen to the Mars Volta.
Yeah, it's like, blow your mind. It's like a constant present tense.
That's just like, amazing.
Just, you know, everything just, every moment just seems so in the moment. But then all the sort of scenery kind of keeps shifting around it.
Yeah.
And it's because it's just got this momentum to it. That's just, and his voice, because he's so rapt when he sings.
And it's genuinely joyous to listen to.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
of his voice. Like, the song on D-Lab, I think it's called Roulette Dares, is just, I think that chorus just always makes me happy. Mm. It's so good. I love it. But yeah, listen to that.
Wow. Yeah. I've also got written down Meshuggah, who we've already talked about. I wrote down Avenged Sevenfold, lol.
Nice.
Because the stage is a prog metal song, so that counts. And if the question is, like, what's the best progressive metal, like, metal that is properly progressive and can be treated as such, then the Red and the Black of the last time I made an album, Book of Souls, is one of the best prog metal songs of all time. So
yeah,
it's a hot take.
I mean, it's an interesting one. Like, where would you draw the line between, say, avant-garde metal and progressive metal?
Sure.
For instance, like, say, in the black metal world, you've got bands like Deathspell Amiga, who will just warp your brain sonically. Mm-hmm. And Blue Tails Nord, who just is that progressive? I don't know. I mean, it's certainly they're doing something different.
It's probably, I mean, there's progressive, and then the question says prog metal. I guess prog is quite
So I want a
specific genre in its own.
Yeah. So when it comes to progressive bands, it's not really just about how technical you are. Or
no.
Kind of thing. Like, the bands that I really love are the ones, I keep going, this is the song I keep saying every time I'm here. But it's like they kind of create their own worlds, and they're sprawling, but it's that sprawling nature that actually helps give you a sense of this kind of space beyond, you know, that exists beyond the record. So, two from Norway, another one I won't go on about too much, I've gone about them before, is Madam Autumn, and the new album is great. And
what are they called?
Madam Autumn. They've been going for about maybe 20 years now. Kind of a critics band, but incredible female singer, Agneta, and just the warmth and the... And the way you talk about Cedric, the way he sings, it's got that kind of wrapped in the moment feel to it, just completely fearless. Another band like that, on a similar tech and on the same label, Vulture Industries, getting less metal as time goes on. But again, they have this kind of very strong sense of kind of slightly Victorian, but apocalyptic world where. You can kind of find yourself living in. And on the British front, two bands I think are doing amazing things at the moment and getting more progressive with each album is Voices. I think every time I hear the new Voices album, and it's gone on a very different tack from the previous one. I've lost a lot of the black metal elements. There's still some left, but not many. And every time I listen to that record, it gets better and better and better. I'm trying to think it's actually a bit of a masterpiece. And that's going to be super high when you get around to writing my albums at the end. And it was great live. And it's just, again, it's just like these people with, there's so much intensity behind it. And, the last album, London, was obviously ahead of its own very sense world. And also, A Forest of Stars, who were amazing at Bloodstock. And the new album is fantastic. And they're getting more progressive, losing a lot of the, some of the black metal elements. And no band creates a world as much as they do. They've got the whole kind of Victorian, black thing, apocalyptic Victorian thing going on. And, the videos are incredible. You should all go and look for Gather of the Pew on YouTube. You'll never see a better video in your life. It must have taken months to produce. And the amount of detail that they furnish their own world with is incredible. And again, it's just, it sounds like someone going mental in Bedlam and having all these visions. And,
amazing.
And but musicianship's kind of becoming much more warm and rich, and another one of my favourite UK bands.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm sure there's lots of kind of more what people would describe as standard prog metal bands that we've probably missed. El would probably be screaming into the mic.
I mean, obviously Opeth.
Well, yeah, Opeth, too. Yeah, Between the Buried and Me.
Yeah,
the latest Anathema album. Incredible as well.
Yeah.
It definitely feels like not only is prog metal or gentle tech or whatever you want to call it bigger than ever, but it seems like you say, Jonathan, way more bands are feeling more fearless to just branch out and get more expansive and get more bold in there.
Yeah,
somewhere.
You could even say Ranzi Pazuzu as well.
Absolutely.
Kind of, and I love Frostlass. They've got that warm progressive feel. Mm-hmm. That's it, Opeth of God.
Definitely.
Adam Turner asks, with reference to Eminem dropping a surprise album today, in the past, which metal band has given you the biggest surprise, be it album, single, cover, that was never expected?
What an album that Eminem album is as well. Unbelievable. Not many metal bands have done the surprise album thing, like properly done it. Cancer Bats did it.
Yeah, on the same day that Sleep did it.
Cancer Bats and Sleep did it. Okay, so yeah, a few have done it actually. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Lamb of God kind of did it. They announced it a little bit far in advance, but no one knew they were working on it. Avenged is the big example. I'm going to go out there and say, before we pick some surprise stuff, I'm going to go out there and say, I don't think this surprise album thing works on metal bands. I really don't. I can't think of any of the bands that have done it where you'd say, them surprise releasing that has done more for them than if they properly let everyone know it was coming and, you know, pushed it and did it in a more quote unquote traditional way.
I think it's realistically, obviously the surprise albums work if you're already massive.
Yeah, like massive. But the thing is, Avenged are the biggest, second biggest metal band of the 21st century after Slipknot. I know they didn't technically start in the 21st century, but you know what I mean. And Avenged would be, if it had been, the first to admit, you know, they didn't, it sold significantly less, and they've said in our own interview back in May, I think it was, that they might have done it a little bit differently, or maybe it didn't work as they planned. But I just think metalheads as a culture like the chance to get excited and feel invested in an album before it comes out.
Yeah, I was just about to say, you know, the anticipation.
Yeah, totally.
You know, because metalheads, you know, a lot of the old school ways of listening to things, metalheads still kind of have, like, you know, that's why vinyl is really big. I remember, like, the anticipation of, you know, putting a needle on a record, waiting for the run out.
Yeah.
You know, Running Groove to hit. I remember, like, reading about a band in a magazine, when I used to read magazines as a kid, but you'd have to wait, like, 2 weeks for it to actually hear it. So you'd spend all that time imagining what it would be like.
Mm.
But by the time it came out, you know, you're kind of already invested in it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, your imagination is invested in it as well, too.
Mm-hmm.
You lose that opportunity. I mean, the Sleep album was potentially such a big event. And we're just like, oh, and then just like... But also because, you know, information moves so fast these days that the supposedly album's out or get washed away by the next thing.
Yeah.
Because you haven't built any foundations for it to kind of stick, like you said, as well, too. So it's just, you know, we live in a much faster information culture now, and there's so many more releases than there probably was back in the day. So it's just like, oh, and then it's just like, next thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the Sleep album, kind of, people almost kind of forget there's a Sleep album this
time. I think people forgot there was a Cancer Bats album.
Yeah.
And that Cancer Bats album's fucking great as well.
Yeah,
so much better than the one before it. It's riffs and riffs and riffs and riffs on it, but... It just seemed to slip under the radar.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, because it seems like a kind of a vanity project in a way.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I guess it depends, really. Like, I can't really imagine like Liam Cormier doing like a vanity project. But
no. In the sense that you think, oh, let's just shock people with an album, and they love it so much they'll be, oh my god, wow.
Yes, I do think so, and I think, to be fair, in some cases bands have probably just gone fuck it. You know, they don't want to do things the traditional way or whatever. I think when Avenged did it, it felt like a cool thing to do. It was a fresh idea for them. Short of Metallica and probably Tool, I can't really think of two metal or any metal bands that I think could genuinely get away with it. If a new Metallica album dropped tomorrow, people would go fucking nuts. Especially if it was like, what I think the reason Eminem's has hit so hard is because A, it's really good, and B, he's tearing the shit out of all these rappers on it. If Metallica suddenly dropped an album and it was like the fastest, thrashiest, most urgent thing they'd done in 30 years, then it would definitely blow the internet up.
Yeah, but I think maybe
that's one very specific example.
But maybe if the Avenged album, being a surprise, wasn't a prog album and instead was harking back to the old school Avenged, do you think it would have had a better, it would have performed better? Do you think
it was
a surprise, but it was also a left turn. Like, doing both at the same time is probably the mistake there. Not the fact that it was a surprise.
Yeah.
It was the fact that it was like, you didn't know this was coming. And most
and his half, 8 minute song.
Yeah, so there's no guarantee you're going to like it. Whereas I think with the Canterbats one and the Sleep one, it was like, here's what we do best. Surprise.
Yeah, totally.
And I think with the Eminem album, it's like, here's what you want from Eminem. Yeah, but surprise. Yeah, it's, and same with, yeah, the Beyonce album, you know, the Jay-Z album came out as a surprise. It was just his us being really good. Whereas I think,
yeah, well, and also, I mean, because that Beyonce and Jay-Z album, they kind of, it's got Beyonce rapping all over it, and it's got loads of mad stuff on it.
Yeah.
So it felt like, I don't know, people seem to be very into it.
Yeah, exactly. And to get into it. And obviously they are, you know, about 10 times the size of Avenged or whatever. But I think if Avenged came out and just did a fucking balls out metal album, it wouldn't have felt like as big a damp squib as maybe the stage it upon its sort of like surprise release. I think doing a left field and a surprise is a risky
move. I think the Eminem made sense because the last album got such a kicking.
If he'd
sort of announced this one ahead of time, people going, oh my god, what's he going to do now? You know, there's that danger.
I think people would have been not that bothered. I mean, I couldn't stand the last Eminem album, thought it was awful. Yeah. And when I woke up the next day and got a Spotify alert saying there's a new Eminem album, I kind of went, woo! And I think if I'd heard there was a new album coming in like a year or something, I'd probably have checked out after a few weeks or something. But I was like, that's interesting, gonna go and check that straight out. And yeah, second you listen to it, you're like, it takes about 2 minutes for you to go, oh my god, this is different to what he's been doing.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, it works if it becomes an event.
Mm. Exactly. Yeah.
And if it doesn't, it looks a bit kind of sad and
totally
tawdry.
I mean, that for me, surprises with albums, like we said, there's been a few that bands have done, but obviously we're in the media, so we get a bit of a heads up on that kind of stuff. For me, it's been real left field music turns that you weren't expecting. Yeah. So the two that came to mind was when I heard Parkway's Ayah for the first time.
Yeah,
I remember sitting in a room with their PR playing it, and the opening bit, the bit when Destroyer goes down 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 down, I actually burst out laughing at first because I was like, what, are you fucking serious? And then Vice Grip played and I was like, what's happened to this band, what's going on? And after a while I got into it, and now I think it's the best album they've ever done. But it really took me by surprise. The same thing happened with the new Ghost album, because you really have to get used to the fact that it's so cheesy and so pop in places, and so you know, kind of shimmery 80s vibe going on. By the time that saxophone came in on Miasma, I was like, what the fuck is going on? But again, now I think it's an instant classic. Well, not an instant classic. I do think it's going to be looked on as a classic album, though. And also, I do remember, speaking of Metallica, they did just drop Hardwired, the single, out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And I remember I was actually at a gig with my family watching Faithless at Brixton Academy.
Amazing.
And I got this notification and I was just like, oh fuck, I've got to make a phone call. So yeah, that was three that genuinely took me by surprise.
I've actually been to like two album launches for like completely left field turns for bands.
Really?
Yeah, the first one was Hypocrisy, when we did Catch 22. And it was at the Nuclear Blast offices, and Catch 22 was one where they went kind of Slipknot-y.
Mm.
And all these Germans, just, you could see them seething. Like, this is not right, this cannot be. And it's just like, you can see all their pencils tapping on the tables, just no, this is not good.
Amazing.
And we went to the listening session for Morbid Angel's Illuds. You know, the one where they went kind of industrial.
Yeah. I like that album.
Good. Well, okay, there's three of us on the planet. Because I thought me, and this includes, I thought me and Don were the only two people on the planet who actually liked that record.
Well, you're the most metal guys at Metal Hammer, so if you like it, I can get you a good album.
But I know when I'm in a minority. And but yeah, there was a lot of bemusement in that room at that time as well.
Yeah, I bet.
What?
That was a crazy left turn.
Yeah, it was, but then they'd already had they'd done industrial stuff with Liebach before. They did the EP with Liebach.
Mm.
And so it wasn't like completely out of the blue, and it still had all the Morbid Angel craziness. And
they still had that song, that Killer Cop song.
But it was
Dull Dagger Buzz.
Yeah, I really liked it because it was Strident's album. Yeah, and the one before that, Heretic, it was just basically Trey's album. It sounded really insular. And I much prefer Illid to that, because it's one, you know, it is kind of ridiculous, but it's like really strident at the same time. So Yeah, so there's been a few things like that. 1349 doing a dark ambient album, which was not entirely successful. Mayhem with Ordered KO, which is one of the strangest and most amazing, like within 1 second I knew this was going to be my album of the year. But it was like real left field turn even for Mayhem, and I think it's one of the greatest records I've ever heard.
What about you, Morten? Any bands that have taken you by surprise?
Not in terms of like going massively left field or anything like that. I think it's when bands go more accessible and I end up liking it is when it sort of surprises me. It's like that the Marmoset album. I remember when they released, I can't remember the first single was off the album, was it Born Young and Free or something? And cause I,
no, it was Move Shake High.
Yeah, and hearing that and going like, oh no, let's stop being that weird little mathy band that I liked who were always opening for everyone. And again, like, oh fuck it, they've sold out, blah blah blah. But then as soon as the album dropped, it's like, no, everything about this album's amazing. This band are obviously brilliant.
Yeah. That's a classic debut.
Yeah, and it was just like, okay, you've changed, but I really like it. Same with, do you think Mastodon, like when they did The Hunter, I saw a lot of people ragging on it online going, oh, you've just written singles, this is rubbish. And I was like, no, it's like, kill. Yeah, exactly. It's like, you're idiots. It's probably the least progressive thing they've
done. I can't think of many bands that did two so different albums. I mean, Crack the Sky to The Hunter was a crazy jump.
But
they both sounded like Mastodon
in
their own ways. And I don't think many bands could do that. And I think both those albums are great.
Yeah, I think The Hunter's probably my favourite album.
Yeah, but it's kind of been, you could predict that they would do something like The Hunter after Crack the Sky. Because there's a lot of cases where a band does something like really huge and progressive or a double album.
Yeah.
And then the next one, they kind of take stock and they need to go back and do some
bangers.
More, something a lot more stripped down, like not do the same thing, not try the same thing twice. There's been quite a few cases of that. You know, both in metal and outside of metal.
Yeah, definitely. I just thought of another really big example was the Suicide Silence album.
Oh, yeah.
Which is kind of the flip side of that, where I really wanted to like it because I really respected what they did. I've talked to Eddie about it loads of times and he believes in it and he believes what it stands for. And I believe in it and I believe in what it stands for. I just didn't think musically it was good enough. No. That's all it comes down to. I've got no issue with what they did. I just didn't like how they did it.
No, I was not into it at all.
Which is a shame because that could have been an album which took them to the kind of size that I think Suicide Silence probably deserve in the grand scheme of things. But
So the Bomb Before was great.
Oh, absolute world destroyer, that album.
Yeah,
world destroyer.
I mean, there's been lots of cases where bands have tried something.
You Can't Stop Me.
Something different.
Yeah,
and they've had to like go back. Obviously, Paradise Lost. You know, they went kind of down the sort of more sort of industrial goth route. My Dying Bride did a kind of a very different album with 0.34, whatever it was, you know, the decimal point one. And it was just not a good album. And it just bands feel they have to sometimes feel they've got to like go off and do something different. But it doesn't normally last. It's just like, okay, that didn't work. We'll go back to doing what we do best.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Let's take another question from the lovely, lovely friends at facebook.com/MetalHammerReading.
Okay, so this is Chris Haylock. It's a longish question, so bear with me. Are there any songs you like which are almost perfect, but there's one little thing that ruins it? For me, it's Moth Into Flame by Metallica, such a good song, but the guitar solo ruins it for me. It sounds like a duck being molested.
Oh, I want to know how you know what that sounds like, to be honest. I love that song. I think that whole song is unbelievable. Best song Metallica has written in 20 years or something, I think I said at the time. Something came to mind, and it's not a song I absolutely love, but it's a song I probably would really, really love if it didn't go so cack at the end. Beating Heart Baby by Head Automatica has...
The metal anthem.
Well, all right. It says any songs.
Yeah.
All right. The pitch change at the end is the worst I've ever heard. The key change, at the end is the worst I've ever heard in a rock song. It's so awful. I was DJing a rock night on Saturday and someone played it, and when it goes into that, it's awful. It doesn't work. Like, even the band sound uncomfortable singing it.
Yeah.
Like, it just doesn't work at all. I think it takes a good song and just ruins it. Also, not really the same thing, but I have to skip on the end of If Eternity Should Fail by Maiden of Book of Souls as soon as Zombie Lad comes in at the end. and starts doing that.
Oh, right,
I love Maiden's goofiness, but it's a little bit much for me. And that's the only thing that gets skipped on that album, so there you go.
I can't remember what the song title's called now. What's the one on Unto the Locust where the kids' choir comes in?
This is who we are.
I really like Unto the Locust as an album. I know it gets panned a lot by people.
I think it's a good album.
It's good. It's something I really like. But I think when the kids' choir comes in, it's just... falls off a fucking
absolutely cliff. Awful. Yeah. I remember saying at the time, if Metallica had done this, they'd have been torn to shreds.
Yeah,
like there would have been no question about it. And bad idea.
Kids' choirs can sound creepy.
Yes,
just not on that one.
I think the new Behemoth album will soon prove everyone right on that. Hint.
Yeah, Floyd. It works.
Floyd's a really good example.
Rodruna, last album had kids' choir, and it sounded like some kind of like kids' army going to come and take her over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely agree about that particular kids' choir, though. I think the biggest issue with Unto the Locust for me was it just wasn't quite the album that people wanted after The Blackening. I actually think Bloodstone and Diamonds was that album. Like, that, if that album had come out after The Blackening, I think it would be a bit of a different...
Which people don't talk about enough.
Well, Bloodstone.
Yeah.
Unbelievable album. So, so good. I'm going to listen to that after this podcast. Any bits that ruin songs for yourselves?
I don't know about ruin songs, but, there's like a famous thing on a Talker album where it's like, you know, one of the true cult black metal artists, and then throughout this one song, and then I kind of think you hear the rest of them, there's this weird like boing, for no reason. It's just throughout this album just goes boing, but it's like a really like unresonant
cartoony spring sound.
And it's just this really unresonant boing that just is there for no reason, and then one of his later albums, more recent
albums, they put a donk on it.
Fuck yeah. What a reference.
Yeah, there's a sudden like banjo break
mid-2000s.
Yeah, this one is kind of black metal, and there's a sudden like banjo break in it for no discernible reason whatsoever.
Wow.
So that's like
that sucks.
Hmm?
But I will not be listening to that.
Nothing wrong with banjos.
No, oh no, absolutely not. In its own, there's a time and a place.
Black metal has never been considered one either of those.
No, fair. This is a good one, and something I've sat and drunkenly done many times. If you ran a festival, this is Hugh Thomas Eggington, sorry, that's asking this. If you ran a festival and had unlimited funds, what would your headliners be, and any other bands you would book?
I've got my headliners, and it's not.
I can guess at least one. Is it Slipknot?
It is,
yes.
Yeah. It's Slipknot playing I Were In Full.
Yes.
And then an encore of my choosing. But the other two are not metal at all, unfortunately, lads. It is Oasis, because I've never seen Oasis.
Oh, hold on, yeah, okay.
And Pink Floyd Reunited, playing exclusively pre-1980s material.
Nice.
And it will be fucking brilliant. And other bands that I've booked, it's just... I don't know what else I'd put, really. I've just written down Let Live and Converge, because obviously I'd pay Let Live to get back together. But that's my headliners. I'll work out other bands I'd book elsewhere, but fuck, that's what I want.
I would go to that 100%.
Who are your headliners, Merlin?
Me. So I've got Maiden. I'm a bit predictable here, but I've got Maiden. If you'd asked me this about 6 months ago and I'd been picking a set list, I probably genuinely would have picked something like they've just done on the Legacy of the Beast tour.
No.
So something like that, a good mix of old stuff, but definitely some newer stuff as well. I'd definitely throw things like Passchendaele back in there. I'd have them playing Alexander the Great. I'd definitely still have them doing Flight of Icarus, definitely have them doing Clansman. They'd probably have to go about 3 hours to fit it all in, but it's my festival, do what I say.
Huh.
I'd have Metallica playing a real rarity set, lots of 90s stuff. Stuff in the 80s albums I don't play quite as much. Definitely playing I Disappear in that as well. So yeah, big bands playing rarer stuff. And I would probably have The Prodigy.
Nice.
As well. Just one of my all-time favourite bands. And then I've just got a list of bands that if I was chucking bands on a bill tomorrow, I'd definitely do. I'll probably have Ghost, Parkway Drive and Gojira as my sub-headliners.
Nice.
And then just spread around the place, I'd have Lamb of God, Mercury, I'd have on the Code Orange, Power Trip and Venom Prison, who we just had on the Hammer Tour, of course. Vane, Carpenter Brut. That's as far as I got, just off the top of my head. But
I'd get D'Anvord to play.
D'Anvord would be amazing. That's like, I saw them at Reading a few years ago. Fucking unreal. I'd have Run the Jewels play as well. Definitely. on a metal day as well, just to make it a weird thing. I don't know why I've written that down, because I just said it, but yeah. Run the Jewels.
Nice. And I'd get Frank back in Gallows for a...
Nice.
For a...
Nice.
To play before Converge.
Oh, definitely. If we're doing that, then I'll have Newstead come up with Metallica for a few 90s tracks.
Nice.
Yeah, I think, well, if I had unlimited funds, I think I'd probably spend it on, like, making it like a multi-century experience.
A 5D cinema.
Yeah, so I'd probably, Pink Floyd would be amazing, but I'd get them to do all these sort of later period spacey stuff. All
right.
I'd basically get around to Pazuzu, my other favourite live band of all time, and just go, right, you have unlimited budget, guys, just turn the entire venue into something that's going to, like, basically make people not know which direction to walk out afterwards.
Break me.
Yeah, I'd basically turn the venue, I'd hold a festival in a planetarium.
Oh, that'd be fucking brilliant.
That'd be good.
So basically I'd just create a huge planetarium and get, like, really spaced out bands. Like, I'd get them, I'd get all the Tampa bands, like, to do that Waste of Space also we did at Roadburn last year.
Mm. Yeah.
And just basically come in and just, you're gonna come out and your DNA will be changed. So I pick bands on that thing. The other thing I always play a little game, like, who would I book for Roadburn that you wouldn't think about, but would be amazing for Roadburn? And on my non-metal tip, I would love to see David Sylvian play live again. It's like the first live band I ever saw. Something that's like, the reason I want to write for magazines, because he was on the cover of a magazine when he was in Japan. And it's like, they're like basically Japan and David Sylvian is my alpha and omega, and he's so reclusive now. I would just, yeah, whatever he needs to come out of solitude and go on a stage, I would just give him that.
Just give him it.
Yeah.
For Roadburn.
Yeah, I could totally see him at Roadburn. I know so many like metalheads, like all the Akiko guys are obsessed with Japan and David Sylvian. Right. The whole 80s thing that's coming back, they defined a lot of that. Japan defined a lot of that aesthetic. So
if you have no idea who Japan are, just jump on Spotify and check out what.
And check out Secrets of the Beehive by David Sylvian. It's beautiful. And he was this huge pop star. They were number 5 in the charts. And then he just went off and did these kind of avant-garde stuff.
The people that did Baby Cakes got a number 1 once, so the number 5 in the charts is...
Yeah,
banger, though,
isn't
it? Yeah, it is.
Yeah, but this is when you have to sell more than, like, 2,000...
Very fair point.
You know, this is my kind of...
I'm just being sarcastic, really. I know that.
No, it would have been in the 80s, actually. So, who was on the front cover of The Sun one time?
Wow.
Was it World's Most Beautiful Man, scarred for life because of a car accident?
Oh, God.
But so many metalheads and so many people into that whole kind of road-burning stuff love David Sylvian. You know, in the same way that, like, people like Scott Walker's is like proper mm-hmm. hotel.
Wow. Book it. But if whoever does Roadburn has unlimited funds. I don't think so, but
yeah.
We got one more question, I think.
Elijah Arnold asks, what do you think of Brent Hines saying he hates being in Mastodon?
Well, that's not what he said.
That's not what he says. I've got some quotes from there. It was quite a bit of a rant, to be fair. This is just a... I can't remember who the interview was with now, but he's... This is some quotes that he's got. More talking about he doesn't hate being a Mastodon. I think it's the music industry.
Yeah, he's talking about the music
that he's taking umbrage with. But it's what I really want to do, and what I hope people let me do, is take some fucking time off and let me breathe. That's how shitty the music industry is, because you've got to work your dick into the dirt before you can see any worms. That's a fucking great sentence. It's definitely the most brutal job I ever had. I'll definitely rather frame houses again. Because I think he's on to say he doesn't want people, you know, looking at him. He doesn't want to be famous. He doesn't give a shit. And he says he's going to take time off, or he doesn't want to play music for a year or two.
Mm.
And going on with another thing he said, sorry, because working your dick into the dirt, I quite like. He says, when the opportunity's there and you strike it and happiness, and then they milk you, talking about the industry, I feel like I'm being milked like a dry hyena titty.
Wow.
So I have nothing left for
so
anyone.
So he's basically fed up of some of the inner workings of the music industry, it sounds like, and it sounds like he feels like the band are under pressure to put music out and to be on the conveyor belt that is the music industry. And it sounds like he really doesn't like being a person of high profile either.
No, I think so.
I think it's like, you know, some bands, when they go from being underground to being like huge, you know, obviously Nirvana being the case in point, you find yourself in a place you never expected to be at.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, especially Mastodon could have never expected to be winning Grammys.
No.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That can't have been on their radar, realistically.
Yeah, but also I remember, like, so I think it was, would have been about 2007, 2008. I did an Access All Airs piece for Metal Hammer with him in Manchester, and I was walking around with Brent Hines, and you know, so many people coming up to him and asked him if it kind of bothered him at the time, and he was like, you know, is it weird for him having that all the time? He's like, no, man, it goes with the job. So he's obviously gone on a journey. You know, yeah, since then, as
well
as
that, but also that's going from being recognised at a gig he's playing,
yeah,
to, you know, now, I mean, Mastodon are probably one of the biggest bands to ever come out of Atlanta. Like, how many bigger bands and artists have come out of Georgia? I mean, obviously I'm talking like heavy rock bands here, so they're probably local celebrities to a lot of people. Yeah. And he's very recognisable. Do you know what I mean? Like, that band are a really recognisable band. They're not just like standard long haired metalhead dudes. So yeah, obviously just not very happy with the way Mastodon are positioned at the moment from a working point of view. I actually had I did an interview with Ben from Arsing Alexandria a few weeks ago that we're going to have in the mag in a few weeks' time, when he talks about something very similar and the attitude that the industry, whether it's us in the media or the people working the bands or, you know, management or labels or whoever it is, there's still a very unhealthy dynamic between how looked after artists are and the workload they're supposed to do, the kind of status they have, the way they're supposed to project themselves as rock stars or whatever. It's interesting to get a little look inside how some artists feel about the way they are getting treated and the way they are being positioned, I guess.
It's sort of weird. It's not weird to see Mastodon in this position, because, you know, they say they are one of the biggest bands in metal, really. They're a festival, they headline Bloodstock and stuff.
Yeah.
But, like, you don't feel like they're a band that are always shoved in your face and they're always something on the go.
No, I mean, and, you know, it's important to point out this is one person's opinion.
No,
and,
no, of course.
And, you know, the guy, the people, as far as I know, the people that work with Mastodon, at least the level I'm aware of, are, you know, good friends with them, know them really well, have known them for years. So I'm not sure exactly who he's taken umbrage at, but he seems to not like the schedule that they have to get back in the studio every 18 months and get back to work and that kind of stuff.
But also, you know, they're playing a lot of like huge arena shows in the US that we might not always know about. You know, they're always playing like huge bands like Slayer or Primus or whatever, you know, who are huge over there. So there's probably like a lot of kind of arena shows that not quite as visible to us.
Yeah, I think as well, the whole circle of, like, you know, you release an album, you talk for 2 years, you get back in the studio again. That, you know, when he says it's the most brutal job I've ever had, you know, it's not physically, you know, it probably is quite physically taxing as well as mentally taxing, that you literally just don't have any time just to sit and put your feet up and watch Netflix. It's just like, yeah, you're out there doing, you know, playing every night, and then you're back in the studio doing it
exactly,
you know, being forced into being creative, which is probably the hardest part.
And the thing is also important to point out that to the average metal fan, Mastodon are a very big band, they play big venues, but, you know, these aren't a bunch of millionaires who can just roll about fucking about doing what they want. They need to work, they need to make money, they need to support themselves. They're not pulling in, I can tell you right now, Mastodon won't be pulling in some massive wage where they can be comfortable and just take it easy. They will have to be getting out and working and keeping on it. And, you know, the music scene can be a very taxing and dangerous place for people, whatever you're doing in it. So,
but it just
sounds, if he's really where he says he is, and that's the kind of time off him and potentially the rest of the band need, I hope that's what they get.
Yeah, I hope so too. Because just reading the rest of it, it's quite a lengthy rant he has. It does sound like he's, you know, not, you know, in a basically a good place and just wants time off. And yeah, hopefully someone would give it to him.
And the last album as well, Emperor of Sand, was a really emotionally taxing album for them. Yeah, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on with those guys, with their families and everything else, and, you know, lots of lost some people, and you know, they're probably knackered and emotionally exhausted, I imagine.
Yeah,
you can't really blame them. We will see what happens. Thank you very much for listening to this week's episode of the Metal Hammer Podcast. We'll be back next week where we will be reviewing Ghost at the Royal Albert Hall. Yes. Holy shit.
Can't wait.
I genuinely don't know the last time, maybe apart from Maiden this year, I don't know if I've been more excited about a single gig this whole year.
Actually, I was at a gig on Friday at the Royal Albert Hall.
Really?
A very non-metal thing. A guy called Yusen Dor. cool. Singer. But John Poe used to play him, and so I like a little kind of world music. But of course, just remember, like, they've got the huge organ at right.
Yeah.
So just, it's going to be amazing.
I can't think of a better modern big metal band to put in that venue. It's going to be wild, and it's the first time any of us will have seen the new songs live.
Oh,
as
shit,
well.
It actually is.
I know. Yeah. When that sax solo comes, man, I'm crowd surfing. Yeah, it's going to be wild. So we will be reviewing that on the podcast next week, as well as unveiling the brand new issue of Metal Hammer. It's a biggie, a first time ever cover for an artist on this issue. Exciting times. The latest issue of Metal Hammer featuring Disturbed is still on sale. Go buy it, and we will be unveiling a special Disturbed bundle either later this week or first thing early next week. Keep them peeled to metalhammer.com. Don't forget to come join us on the readers group. Subscribe on iTunes and Acast, and leave us a review as well. Tell us how much you love us.
Loads.
Loads. See you next week, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.